Sacre Bleu, not France, too. We'll talk about the fiscal crunch now ruling the French headlines.
And Chicago teachers take to the streets for the second day in the strike. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Tuesday, September 11th. Also, as Apple prepares to debut the iPhone 5 tomorrow without Steve Jobs, we'll look at what it takes to make a good pitch man out of a CEO.
And we hear from one Virginia county whose changing demographics mean it could be a squeaker in the presidential race. That and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
30,000 teachers are on strike again today in Chicago after the city and the teachers' union failed to reach an agreement yesterday. Our own David Gura joins us now from Washington to talk about some of the major sticking points. Good morning, David.
Morning, Stacey.
So give us some details, if you will. Why are the Chicago teachers striking?
So the union says this is fundamentally about two things. The first is how teachers are evaluated, how much their performance and the performance of their students on standardized tests affects how much teachers get paid and what kind of raises they get. And the second is job security. The union wants a guarantee that if a teacher gets laid off, he's going to get first dibs on any new position that opens up. Now, the city wants more flexibility to decide who should teach and who shouldn't, Stacey. And it wants, and it says it needs more flexibility to deal with its deficit.
Well, how big is that deficit? And also, David, to what extent is this kind of thing playing out across the country?
Well, this is a big school system, the third biggest in the country, 350,000 students. And right now it's looking at a $665 million deficit. And that's projected to climb up to $1 billion pretty fast. And the reason for that, the city says, is because of rising pension costs and low revenues. And I asked Robert Custrell to put that in context for me. He teaches education at the University of Arkansas.
I really don't know how the math is going to work for districts like Chicago. They're facing pretty dire circumstances.
Custrell told me he's looked at the finances for many different city school systems.
Not specifically Chicago, but I've looked at Milwaukee. I'm looking at school districts in Pennsylvania that are facing crushing burdens with growing pension costs. There's going to be bankruptcies.
Philadelphia schools face a $282 million deficit, and in Cleveland, the school's chief is talking about laying off as many as 600 teachers, Stacey, to close a $65 million budget gap.
Well, to change directions a little bit, David, summer is over. What are parents doing with their kids in Chicago right now?
Oh, it's tough, no question. The school district does have some facilities open. They're providing childcare on a limited basis. You mentioned summer. There are also strike camps throughout the city, kind of like summer camp continued and happening all over Chicago.
All right. Our own David Gura in Washington. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Well, Stacey, mixed trading days for stock markets in Asia and in Europe. But so far here in the U.S., at least at this point in the morning, markets are off to a good start. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 0.5%. The S&P 500 up about 0.3%. And the NASDAQ up 0.2%. The European Central Bank made news last week. We talked about this when it said it is ready to buy Spanish and other government bonds if countries need that kind of bailout. Well, today markets are digesting, in Europe in particular, some prickly comments from Spain's prime minister in a television interview. He said there are a number of, quote, red lines the country will not cross in order to qualify for those bailout funds. Presumably, he's talking about the same kinds of austerity plans and government cuts that have been difficult to implement in Greece and Portugal. France this week is confronting its own financial troubles, and we'll talk about France a little bit later in the show.
For now, a little fashion. That's kind of French, right? Fashion?
Oui, oui.
Shares of Burberry are down more than 18% this morning. The luxury retailer slashed profit forecasts and warned that the luxury goods market is headed for hard times. We spoke to Milton Pedraza, CEO of the Luxury Institute, about the causes and potential effects. He says the market has been dependent on China for some time, but that's starting to crumble.
China had been the engine of growth for the last several years. And China not only had the effect of growing in its own market, but it generated a tremendous number of tourists who have been holding up the European luxury market. So not only has China's slowdown affected its own market, but it also had been holding up Europe, and therefore now Europe has slowed down, and the effect of the local European market, which has been negative, has now been exacerbated by the lack of tourism from China.
Well, Stacey, today is Tuesday, and if you count out a certain number of Tuesdays, the presidential election is exactly 8 weeks away.
The superest Tuesday.
Yay. As part of our coverage of what matters to voters, we've been calling it the real economy. We've got the first in a series of stories from Loudoun County, Virginia. Virginia is a swing state that could help decide the presidential race, and Loudoun County is seen as one of the hinges that Virginia could turn on. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
On Capitol Hill, Democrats and Republicans sit on either side of the aisle. Here in Loudoun County, about 35 miles from the Capitol, the dividing line is Route 15, separating east from west. I'm lurching along 15 with Liz Whiting, a local lawyer and historian who's giving me a tour of the east.
So there's, you know, always been that east-west split. It's been the question of what are the issues.
Slavery was the issue during the Civil War. People in the East owned slaves. Folks in western Loudoun did not. Today, people clash over growth. Loudoun's population surged 84% from 2000 to 2010. Owners of horse farms in western Loudoun go fox hunting and buy up land for preservation. Most of the growth is in the East. It spawned traffic jams and, Whiting says, resentment.
Are we the East required to absorb the growth because you still want the pastures for your horses?
The newcomers in the East are more middle and working class. They've turned this once reliably Republican county into a toss-up. 33-year-old Megan Tolosa voted for President Obama in 2008. Since then, she and her husband Michael have struggled with unemployment and an underwater mortgage. And Tolosa has been reevaluating the president.
He just seems so tired, and he doesn't seem his happy self anymore. He just seems kind of defensive a lot, and I just feel like he's not a strong leader.
But Tolosa doesn't like Governor Romney much either. She says he doesn't care enough about the poor. But drive out to western Loudoun County, and Romney's signs start to sprout along the country roads. I meet another local historian, Eugene Scheel, at a family restaurant in the village of Purcellville.
Now, this is not food that your doctor ordered.
Over lunch, Scheel tells me that a few years ago, activists in the West tried to secede from Loudoun and form their own county, free of the changing demographics of the East. But they couldn't get approval from the state legislature. Scheel says the East and West remain two different worlds.
I think these worlds will remain the same. I don't think they're going to get together.
They will vote together on November 6th. How it'll turn out here is anybody's guess. I did see those Romney signs in western Loudoun, but just as many Obama bumper stickers in the traffic-choked East. In Loudoun County, Virginia, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
And before we leave the realm of election news, Stacey, Larry Flynt, you know Larry Flynt, right?
Oh, yes, yes,
Hustler, right?
Hustler Magazine.
Not personally, but you know of him.
No, not personally.
Founder of Hustler Magazine, of course, and free speech advocate, is again pulling out his pocketbook in search of political dirt. Readers of today's USA Today will open it up to find Flynt's full-page ad that offers a $1 million reward for information leading to the capture or whereabouts of Mitt Romney's tax returns.
Really?
Specifically, quote, unreleased tax returns and or details of offshore assets, bank accounts, and business partnerships. This has become sort of a pattern for Larry Flynt. In recent years, you might recall he's posted rewards for details of extramarital affairs by specific Republican politicians. And the update on the Romney tax return thing, for those who haven't been keeping score, is that he has released his tax returns for 2011 and for 2010, but he won't share any before that. So that's what Larry Flynt is after. And if you have anything to share, you folks out there, he promises, Larry Flynt that is, to keep you confidential. So it's not like you have to pose in the magazine or anything.
Well, that's good.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
After a 7-year effort to open up a part of the Arctic Ocean to oil drilling, Shell Oil ran into problems on its second day of work. Sea ice forced the vessel to temporarily stop operations. The oil giant has a lot at stake with this well, as Scott Tong reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
To get an idea how early this is, Shell is drilling a pilot hole to explore what may be down there. And it can't get within 4,000 feet of the presumed oil and gas. The feds have to approve a safety barge now in the lower 48. I.e., the relationship with regulators just started. International energy consultant David Goldwyn.
They're going to make sure that Shell has the oil spill response in place. They're going to have a limited number of wells.
Then Shell has to please investors. It'll probe the geology under the ice, define the oil fields, make an environmental plan, and get Washington to sign off. Maybe a decade before oil flows. Still, an economic page is turning in the previously frozen north, says Malte Humpert of the Arctic Institute think tank.
20 years ago, the Arctic, it was covered by ice year-round, and in the next 10, 20 years, you're looking at a new frontier, just like the American West.
That frontier is water free of ice a couple months a year. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Stacey, I'm sure you and I will talk about this at the time. A court decision in Germany could throw EU bailout plans into turmoil. There's a court that has to decide whether Germany's contribution to the monetary fund that will help fund the bailout is constitutional. Until then, the euro's second largest economy, France, has been very much in the spotlight the last few days. France finds itself in kind of a similar bind to Greece, Italy, and Spain. How do you balance the state budget without stalling your economic growth? It's not easily done. And President Francois Hollande has seen his approval ratings plummet. The BBC's Hugh Schofield is with us now from Paris. Good to talk with you, Hugh.
And to you.
From reading things over here, one could get the impression that France risks becoming Europe's next basket case economy. Is that overstating things, you think?
It's slightly overstating things, but probably not that much overstating things. I mean, things feel bad and things look bad here. Unemployment's just gone through the 10% mark. Growth is static. And there's this general feeling of drift and that nothing is seriously being done to take on these, you know, these huge problems, quite apart from the fact that the budget deficit, of course, is also, very, very large and needs to be brought down urgently.
President Hollande gave a TV interview the other day, clearly trying to be very demonstrably assertive. I am in battle, he said. I'm accelerating. I know where I'm going. Why this over-the-top effort to show he's got a backbone?
Precisely because the accusation was that he doesn't have a backbone. I mean, he'd come into power 4 months ago very much on the basis that he represented a kind of anti-Nicolas Sarkozy. And the prevailing impression here is that for the last 4 months, he's just rested on that justification. He's undone a lot of what Nicolas Sarkozy did, but there's been no sense that he's got a program himself to tackle these urgent problems.
The other catalyzing event in recent days was France's richest man, the head of Louis Vuitton, applying for citizenship in Belgium. And this happens suspiciously as France is about to roll out a new 75% income tax rate on millionaires. How did that play out in France?
Well, I mean, it all ties in. I mean, part of the Hollande package is tax rises. And of course, it will hit the very richest. Now, as you say, just as this happened, Bernard Arnault, the head of LVMH, the luxury goods business, announces that he's seeking Belgian nationality. Now, the communications game is very subtle here. He's then immediately said, don't worry, I will continue to pay French taxes. I'm not leaping to another country straight away. But I think no one is fooled. No one is fooled. I mean, it is a signal. It's a shot across the bows by a man who's known to be very opposed and very sceptical about the socialist government's policies, not just because it affects him personally, but because he thinks it affects the whole aura and the whole ambiance in France for businessmen like himself.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. Thank you.
Thank you.
Apple is expected to unveil the new iPhone 5 at a huge press conference tomorrow in San Francisco. Are you an iPhone user, Jeff?
I'm an Android guy. Don't get me started.
An Android guy? No, I'm just kidding.
As a journalist, I respect both devices. As a personal user, I choose Android.
Yes. Well, of course, part of the reason the Apple products became so big is because of the way they were pitched. No one really pitched a product like Steve Jobs did. Mm-hmm. He made these launches and events famous. But this time, of course, Apple's chief presenting officer will not be Steve Jobs. It will be Tim Cook. And now Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman takes a look at what it takes to turn a CEO into a pitch man.
Remember this guy?
My advertising might be good, but it's nowhere near as good as my chickens.
That was Frank Perdue hawking his tender birds in the 1970s. So the CEO as pitchman idea wasn't invented yesterday. Lee Iacocca did it for cars. Dave Thomas did it for Wendy's hamburgers. But Apple completely changed the game, says technology analyst Carl Howe at the Yankee Group.
Steve Jobs really set a gold standard, that they made their CEO the celebrity.
Now, says Howe, the CEO as brand ambassador is something the technology market demands.
Because most ordinary people don't understand all the bits and pieces. So they're looking for somebody they can trust who will tell them why they should buy it.
But the CEO may not be persuasive or charismatic, says management consultant Peter Cohen.
Not everybody can do it as well as Steve Jobs, and everybody just looks sort of pathetic by comparison.
Cohen says Jeff Bezos pulls it off pretty well for Amazon these days, but Nokia's Stephen Elop and Microsoft's Steve Ballmer, not so much.
The damage can go beyond just not really being that effective as a salesperson. It could also be demoralizing to employees. It could be demoralizing to investors.
Or worse, says David Riebstein, a professor of marketing at the Wharton School.
What happened if something non-favorable press happens for that individual? So, for example, Martha Stewart wearing the clothes and showing it as fashion.
Until her fashion statement ran to prison jumpsuits. Bad for Stewart, bad for the brand. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeff, Seattle's best coffee company is combining some breakfast favorites for a new coffee flavor.
Donut orange juice coffee?
Oh, that sounds kind of good. No, bacon coffee. Bacon coffee.
Of course, bacon, yeah.
Right? The flavor was the winner of the company's Red Cup Showdown. That was a contest that took place at state fairs across the U.S. And Des Moines resident Eileen Gannon took home the trophy. Apparently, her coffee tastes like bacon and there's like a hint of pumpkin spice. And this is where I need to bring you in for your expertise, Jeff.
Okay.
Because she called the flavor How to Win a Guy with One Sip. What do you think? Bacon coffee? Would you be won over with one sip?
Because guys love bacon even in liquid form.
I guess so. It's like the most efficient possible way to have bacon.
That's right. They say the path to our heart is through our stomach, and there's no quicker way to get bacon to our stomach than by drinking it. So, sure.
All right. So. Okay. Well, we'll call it fair. How to Win a Guy with One Sip, Bacon Coffee. Mm-hmm. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.